Christo versus Johnson. As you get settled, I'm sure you're aware the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes, and the appellant finally will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone, just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, and you may begin, please.
Please the court. My name is David Krause. I represent David and Barbara Johnson, the appellants in this case. On August 20th, 2012, the Johnsons sold a piece of rental property in Minneapolis to the respondent. On October 29, 2017, a little more than 5 years later, the Johnson served a notice of cancellation of the contract for deed on the respondent. Under Minnesota Statute 559.21, the service of a notice of cancellation starts the running of a 60-day period. During that 60-day period, the contract vendee can either cure the default or obtain a court order suspending the running of the 60-day period. In this case, late in the 60-day period, the respondent filed a case in the district court, and on December 20, 2017, the district court issued an order for a temporary injunction against the Johnsons. Now, the first point that we have made is that although the court issued an order for a temporary injunction, the order did not become effective then. First of all, Minnesota Statute 559.211 expressly provides that a proceeding to suspend the running of the 60-day period is subject to Rule 65 of the Rules of Civil Procedure that deal with injunctions. Rule 65 says expressly that no temporary injunction shall issue except upon the posting of such security as the court may determine. Now, I recognize that the statute gives the court the right to suspend this posting of the, or waive the posting of the security. But the court didn't do that. The court required security, and so under the rules, the restraining order did not become effective until the security was posted, which was beyond the end of the 60-day period.
Can I ask you, and I understand your statutory arguments, but the court relied upon a case, DJ Enterprises. It's a decision from this court where the, and I, if I'm, I'm gonna summarize what I think the holding was, where basically the, this court said, it is, so long as the person that's subject to the cancellation brings the motion within the statutory period of time, we're going to exercise our equitable authority, and basically that'll bring everything, you know, that'll hold everything. or toll everything until the court has been able to rule. And why wouldn't that case apply here where we actually have a dispute as to what the terms of the contract were, whether there was even a balloon date?
Well, the first, with regard to that, the case you're referring to, that was a case where the hearing occurred during the 60-day period, but the order was due to the court delaying and the issuing of the order that occurred after the end of the 60-day period. In this case, the failure to post the bond within the 60-day period is strictly on the respondent. The respondent could have done it within the 60-day period and didn't do it. Now, so any problem here is not due to the court, as in the case the court is referring to, but to the on the fault of the respondent herself.
Except here the court said, and I'm paraphrasing again, and tell me if I'm wrong, the court basically looked at it and said, well, I didn't mean for it to not be effective, there's a conflict in the way the order's written, and I'm going to resolve that conflict in such a way as to favor the the person subject to the cancellation.
Well, if
so doesn't that?
Yeah,
that the court apparently made a discretionary call.
I don't see it as the court
interpreted it its own order.
It's your turn.
It's your turn. So if you could respond.
I mean, basically, as I read it, the court said, oops.
Yeah, I don't see it as a discretionary call.
Okay.
First of all, because the statute expressly says that after the contract terminates, the court doesn't even have the authority to enjoin or restrain the cancellation. So it's not a typical situation where there's a discretionary call, but I'm not familiar with any theory of judicial discretion that permits the court to ignore the plain language of its own order.
Let me ask this. It sounds like you're making a almost de facto jurisdictional argument.
Yes.
Are you saying this court had no jurisdiction over the case then?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the district court did not have authority to issue an injunction after the 60-day period.
Jurisdictional then?
Pardon?
Isn't that jurisdictional?
No. No, it's not jurisdictional. The case is properly before the court.
And again, DJ Enterprises, again, you're saying that it's up to, in that case, they're saying it's up to the court if they want to exercise its equitable authority. And in this case, the judge and basically saying, I didn't write this order right, isn't this simply an exercise of the equitable powers of the court in correcting an order that didn't say what the judge intended it to say?
I don't think that the equitable authority extends to changing an order retroactively, where the substantive rights of my clients have intervened. This to deprive my clients of that right, in my judgment, extends beyond the equitable authority of the district court.
Well, except here, the court found that your client didn't have a right to cancel. Your client didn't have a balloon date. So if in fact that is the ultimate determination here, the court has to, doesn't the court have to decide which version of the contract it will accept, and in order to do that, the court had to set it up for an evidentiary hearing and told the cancellation.
I respectfully disagree that the statute is clear that at the end of the 60-day period, all defenses and claims are gone. And so if the 60-day period expired without the Johnsons being effectively restrained, the contract's over. There's a reason Minnesota has that law, and it's been the law a long time.
And I understand that, but that very statute was at play in the DJ Enterprises case. And in that case, the court cites prior case law that says we're dealing with an all too inelastic statute. It does not discriminate as law ought to discriminate between those who deserve its indulgence and those who have forfeited all right to it. And then it talks about the vendee has made substantial payments, has added substantial value to the improvements, and is in possession, and they may be canceled out and perhaps his entire estate forfeited, and we're going to intervene here. And the district court relied on this case in saying the statute says what it says, but as long as the right to toll that cancellation has been exercised by the vendee, the court will intervene. And I guess I don't know how I distinguish this case from DJ Enterprises. And that's what I need to hear from you.
Well, I don't see those things as having, I respectfully submit, having anything to do with this complying with the 60-day rule under the statute. This is a system where people buy real estate all the time based on the fact that the notice of cancellation was filed and it wasn't cured. But so the question is under the statute, did they obtain a court order that stopped the running of the 60-day period within the 60 days? They did not because, first, they didn't file the bond. Secondly, because the order is clear. I mean, how else would you write a contract or a statute with an effective date provision that's any clearer? So,
well, is the order clear though? I mean, because it says it's immediately effective. I mean, there's an immediate action in one paragraph, and then the next paragraph it says it becomes effective upon posting of the bond. Well, how can it be both?
Well, no, respectfully disagree, Your Honor, that it says this order. That refers to the entire order.
I mean, but the judge looked at that and thought there was an inconsistency and resolved it.
Well, maybe the judge said that, but the judge is bound by the plain language of the order. And you can't change the order after the end of the 60-day period, which is what you're doing if you change the effective date provision.
But you said that it was properly before the court. The case was properly before the court, right?
Yeah, the case before the?
Right.
Yeah.
So you're saying after the 60 days, the court has no authority?
I'm saying that if the injunction doesn't issue within the 60-day period, the contract's over, the court made its injunction conditional.
So you're saying the court can't do anything after 60 days?
Right. That's my position. The law is clear.
Ends after 60 days.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
Then, following up on Judge Hooten's question, I mean, I might be inclined to agree with you, but DJ Enterprise, which is one of our decisions, the district court took the motion for an injunction under advisement and did not issue the injunction until about a month after the expiration of the 90-day window. The question appeals whether the district court had jurisdiction to issue an injunction beyond that 90-day window, and we said yes. So
yeah,
what do we,
no question.
I mean, so what do we do? Do we just say, we, you know, just like the district court sort of did, oops, we should say, oops, you know, we shouldn't have said that? Is that what you want us to say?
Well, as I said before, I don't think the case can be extended where the failure is due to the respondent. The respondent could have filed the bond. We didn't stop him from doing it. The second reason that the injunction didn't become effective within the 60-day period has to do with the notice requirement. Again, the statute says the process is subject to Rule 65. Rule 65 says that a party is bound when they have actual notice. Here we have a court determination, the district court determined in one of its orders that the Johnsons didn't have actual notice until after the end of the 60-day period. I think that the rule, especially with the comment and the reference to the federal rule, it's clear that the actual notice requirement applies to parties as well as their agents. I've had cases where we've gotten a restraining order ex parte because of an emergency situation. Of course, the party to be restrained isn't bound until they know about it. And that's what they're saying here, is that even though the Johnsons don't know about it, they're bound by this order. And I think the part of the confusion here is on the part of the respondent is they don't distinguish between the fact that contracts aren't being enjoined. It's people that are being enjoined. So the fact the court issues an order about a contract, the order is preventing people, the Johnsons, from proceeding with the cancellation. And that doesn't happen until they know about the order.
Thank you, Mr. Krauss. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
May it please the court, Karen Cole and Richard Hendrickson for respondent Monica Cristo. The district court heard argument during the 60-day period. The Johnsons were served and given notice before that hearing occurred. Under the provisions of Section 559.21. The district court took that under advisement and issued its decision on December 20th. That TRO that the court issued was ambiguous. It provided at the end that the effective date of the order would take place when bond was posted. But at two other places in the order, the court said that the Johnsons were immediately restrained. So there was an ambiguity there. The court had the authority after the fact, nunc pro tunc, to clarify that order, to reflect the court's actual intent, and the court did so. That clarification related back and stopped the clock stopped the 60-day clock so that there was no cancellation. The controlling case here is Styler. That case said, and the other cases that have been cited, say that the court has inherent authority to clarify a decision. It has that authority where there was an ambiguity, as in this case, and where the court is modifying the order to reflect its original intent, where it's clarifying, not changing its order. And that's what occurred here. The district court explained that clearly in her June order. The court was not trying to engineer some different result than it had originally intended, as in two of the other cases that have been cited, where a nunk-pro-tunk modification of the contract or of the order was not allowed. At one point, counsel has said, I believe, that a nunk-pro-tunk clarification cannot clarify a substantive right or decision. That is incorrect. The Styler case involved a situation where there was an order dividing marital property. The order did not take into account all of the property, so that after the fact, the appellate court, the Supreme Court, said that the court did have authority to go back and clarify its order. The court said that even though the district court below had not even reached that, had not even attempted to make a clarification. The court said that the district court had abused its discretion by not even entertaining a request to clarify the order. So we believe that that there's full authority for the clarification nunk-pro-tunk of the court's order so that the bond.
Ms. Cole, does the court's ability to clarify its order depend on whether or not the order is ambiguous?
Yes.
Okay, and so if the order is not ambiguous, you don't get to just kind of change your mind?
That's correct.
Okay, and your point is, you know, it says, as Judge Hooten correctly pointed out, you know, effective immediately, and then later it says, but you got to post the bond, and, you know, that does seem to conflict, so that's the ambiguity.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. What about Mr. Krause's second argument that, you know, if you're going to be bound by the TRO, you have to have actual notice of it? And the comments and the federal rule seems to support that. So what, why shouldn't we sort of go with that?
Yes, Your Honor. The federal rule does not apply to this case. Minnesota rule 65.04, adopted by the Supreme Court, does control in this case. And the text of it is different from the federal rule in a critical way. Without getting into every comma involved, the rule 65.04 divides persons affected by that rule into two clumps. One, parties, and there is no actual notice requirement as to parties. The second clump is persons in active concert with parties. And the actual notice requirement does apply to that second clump of persons. The text of the rule is clear. The actual notice provision does not apply to parties. And
what's the reason for that distinction in your mind?
Well, one good reason for that distinction is that parties have been served with a summons and complaint and with a motion for injunctive relief, as in this case. Parties know that they may be subject to a TRO, and they're able to order their affairs to anticipate that possibility. That is not the case necessarily for persons in active concert with parties who are more removed from the action. But regardless of the rationale or the policy reasons behind the rule, the actual language of the rule controls. The Supreme Court can amend its rule, but we have to comply with the rule as it was written, and there is no actual notice requirement. The other side has said that the Dahlberg requirements were not met, so that an injunction was not properly entered. And that argument hinges on the supposition that there were two writings that needed to be harmonized. But as Judge Hooten has recognized, the question here is not the harmonization of different writings. The question is which writing controls. And our client.
And the district court made that very clear as to which one it believed.
The district court made that very clear.
And that's supported by the record.
Pardon me?
And that decision is supported by the record, correct?
It is very supported by the record. Our client testified that the preliminary discussions about the contract did not include any reference to balloon payments. She was asked to sign the contract for deed. She studied it. It did not have any provision for balloon payment. She testified that the second writing that she signed also did not have any provision for balloon payment, and that she was shocked when she, years later, after investing in the property and making payments, received a notice of cancellation. The district court found our client credible and found her account credible at four separate points in her decision in August granting the preliminary injunction.
No, I got that. It was pretty clear the district court was making a point as to who it believed.
Right. And in addition to that factor, likelihood of success on the merits, two other factors here are very strong. One is when you look at the balancing of the harms, our client has invested substantial amounts in this property that she would lose. The other side, the only harm to the other side is some delay. So that factor strongly supports our client. In addition, another factor under Dahlberg is the public policy that is at issue. And in this case, we have a statute, sections 559.21 and .211, that reflect a very strong public policy that where a TRO is properly obtained during the 60-day period, the clock stops running so that the merits can be determined at trial. And that policy is very strong because the contract for deed, Vendi, stands to lose a substantial amount, as in this case. So we think the Dahlberg factors were fully satisfied. The court properly exercised its discretion. The court properly considered parole evidence in making that decision. The bond requirement was not a barrier. The district court, in its June decision, properly found that that requirement was not binding and did not prevent the clock from stopping. And Rule 65.04 is plain. The actual notice requirement does not apply to parties. If the court does not have further questions, I will conclude.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Cole. Mr. Krause, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you.
May it please the court. With regard to the notice requirement, again, it's like the bond situation. Nothing prevented them from giving notice to the Johnsons, actual notice of the order during the 60-day period. And there's no evidence that they even tried to do that during the 60-day period.
Well, I mean, I think they would say they don't have to. They would, Mr. Krause, I think they would say, well, if you look at the rule, they don't have to. So, and I mean, whether that's right or wrong, you could read the rule that way.
If you adopt that,
that's a problem.
The rule, then what can I say? I don't think it's tenable, but that'd be true. The counsel for respondents said that I had argued that the court can't clarify a substantive right. We aren't talking about clarifying here. We're talking about changing a substantive right. With regard to the two writings, what we're talking about are two writings signed almost simultaneously at the same time. If anything should be construed together, it's those. There's no dispute that they were signed by the respondent.
Well, can I ask you about that? Because the court had to decide which of the two versions of this contract to apply. And I know you argued that they should be read together, but the court viewed it as it's one or the other. And because there was a conflict in the two versions, the court allowed Perot evidence, and in doing so, made credibility determinations. And in fact, found that the respondent here was more credible as to what occurred at the time of the at the time they entered into the contract. How do we, as a reviewing court, reverse that? That those findings as to what was more credible and also what the court deemed to be the correct contract that should be applied here.
Your Honor, I respectfully challenge the premise, which is that district court had to choose between two writings. Under the circumstances, the two writings have to be construed together. You know, the missing balloon payment date in one of the documents is not the only missing date. There's also in her document the date that, or the month that installments began is missing. You know, of course installments have to begin, but you have to come up with evidence that would establish, if there was only one document, evidence that would establish when the payments begin. Now, here, parole evidence, I'm wrong, and the court decides that there are two documents and that respondent's document is the governing one, even then, you can't get to the conclusion of the district court, which is there's no balloon payment date, because the district court ignores the language that precedes the missing date, which clearly calls for a balloon payment. You can't construe that document as not providing for a balloon payment. And the only type of parole evidence that would possibly, if that's the governing instrument, that would be admissible would be what is the balloon payment date? Not that there's no balloon payment. Now, I also want to mention, I think this is important, the balancing of the harms. Of course, counsel for respondent did a good job and is talking about the harms to her client. But what about the Johnsons? They sold this property for $175,000. The down payment's only $5,000, less than 3%. That's a benefit that the respondent got. The monthly payment's only $1,200. That's a benefit that she got. What about the harms from all of this that has happened to the Johnsons? They haven't received any money for over a year. How about balancing that harm in to the equation?
But aren't they paying the money to a trust fund for the attorney?
I haven't seen any trust fund. Okay. That's nobody notified me of that. There's nothing in the court record indicating that the court approved a trust fund that it was ever established. I mean, the respondent admitted under oath that she knew about the order to make the payments to the Johnsons, and she didn't do it on the advice of her attorney. That is violating a court order, if anything, if there ever was. And a party that does that loses on the balancing of the harms and is not entitled to equitable relief.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Krause. The matter is submitted.